The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ, and He shall reign forever. These are words that echo in the hearts and minds of all God-fearing people, and especially God's elect this time of year. In little less than 3 weeks, we'll observe the Feast of Trumpets, a day that culminates in the fulfillment of those words I just read. A day that we all, in our hearts and minds, look forward to. And it is the pivotal moment, or the next pivotal moment, I should say, in the plan of God, when again, all of man's systems come to an end. And Christ stands on the Mount of Olives and begins a new era and a new age for all of humanity. And again, even some of the words we just sang, there'll be peace in the whole world when He comes. It's that day. But brethren, we look forward to that day, that's true. And that is a vision we will get in about 3 weeks again. And we will get more of it at the feast. We rehearse that every time at this time of year. But there is a day. There is a day and a date, if you will, prior to that. And that's the day you and I are called to work toward. We don't always focus on it. We think of that day. We think of the day Christ will stand on the Mount of Olives. But there is a day we are told and called to prepare for that happens well before that. That's what I want to talk about today. Because if we're not prepared, that day, as the Bible calls it, can come upon us unawares. It can approach us and it can pass us by and we may not even know it. Again, it can be a day just like today. Nice and sunny out. Not much really bad. The world kind of goes on. There's disasters like we talked about. But the world goes on. But this is the day that we work for. That we are called to look forward to. I want to take a look today at one key biblical principle that should help inform us of what our work and our effort is towards. And the way I've worded it, you could word it several different ways, but the way I've worded it is to be prepared on the day of decision is to have been prepared all along. To be prepared on the day of decision, and that's the day we're working toward. That's the day that should be forefront in our minds. That's the day that makes the difference for all who God has called at this time. There are two quintessential examples in the Bible. And, you know, sometimes I think we read over these or we ignore them because, well, you know, we know all about it. But these are the examples that the New Testament apostles use. So we're going to look at them. But we're going to look at them from this vantage point. Again, to be prepared on that day is to have been prepared all along. So I want to start back in Genesis 6. You will recognize Genesis 6, obviously, is the story of Noah. But again, we're not going to read the whole thing. We're just going to take out some points relative to this topic that we're discussing today. Genesis chapter 6, and we'll start in verse 5. Then the Lord. I want to stop right there. Note who is saying this. Note who is making this statement, if you will, or who is making this judgment call and when he's doing it. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of the heart was only evil continually. This is something God saw from heaven, if you will. He made an assessment. He looked down on the state of mankind as a group and said they are wicked and they are evil. And their hearts are only evil continually. So again, it's very important, and this begins to speak to that point, or the essence of the point that we're working toward, that there is a day of decision that we work toward. And to be ready for that day, we must be ready now. So again, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth. And he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." So not only did God make an assessment, a judgment, if you will, on the state and the affairs of man as a group, and as we know, that assessment is accurate, but we also know ahead of the story, there was some righteous within the community of the earth, if you will. But now he passes a judgment and he makes a decision. He makes a decision that he will destroy everything. Now, it's always fascinated me, this verse. I shouldn't say always. Once you read it, you're kind of like, what did the creeping things do? You know, what did the birds of the air? But he's saying it was all wicked. It was all evil. And it was all corrupt. And it's all got to go. So again, I don't know what they did, but it's interesting that everything was corrupt in his eyes and his assessment. Reading on, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Note whose eyes it was that Noah found grace in. It was in the eyes of the Lord. It wasn't another person. It wasn't another man. And what do we try to do today in our life? I know for me, and it's been a battle all my life. I want other people to like me, and I want them to think I'm pretty good. It doesn't matter. God didn't come down and ask all of Noah's neighbors, "Now, what do you think? Do you like him? Is he good? Is he a good neighbor? Did he help you out? Did he help mow your yard?" Didn't ask him that. God said it. God made the judgment, and God's sitting on his throne in heaven, and he's the one that said, "He found grace in my sight." This is the genealogy of Noah. He was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Again, a great statement. I think anybody in this room would love to have written about us. You walked with God. This is God's assessment. "And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their ways on the earth." Again, this is completely God's assessment. We've talked through several points. We're going to come back to these. We're going to see another example with almost every one of those points being made. "So God looked upon the earth." We read that. "And God said to Noah," verse 13, "now God informs Noah, his servant on the earth, of a decision that was just made." Now the person Noah finds out about it. But see, the decision, the day of decision, was a day just like today. And Noah did not know it went on. He did not know that decision was made in heaven until after the fact. And his servant was informed. "And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy the earth." This is when God informed his servants. So again, there is a time. There is a decision point. And God makes it in heaven before informing his servants. Now, Noah's warned. If you go back and read the story, God does say, you know, man's got about 120 more years to correct this, or I'm wiping him out. You know, commentaries will put some of these conversations about 80 years out from the flood. But again, who made the assessment? When was it made? And how did he inform his servants? I think it's very instructive to contemplate these. Drop down, if you would, again, the rest of this. God, it's actually kind of interesting because this is the beginning of God's dissertation or his dialogue with Moses. It's all one-sided. God feeding into him. This is how he starts, and he goes on and tells him about an ark. If you look at the beginning of each one of the verses in between here, every one of them starts with a quote. And I find this actually quite instructive. We come all the way down to verse 21, and that's where God's quote ends. So we pick it up in verse 22. "Thus Noah did." You get the idea. God stopped talking. He probably was standing there with his mouth open a little bit, or kind of like, "You got to be kidding. What am I?" You know. He went out and got to work. He didn't play around. He didn't debate God. He didn't do a lot of other things. "Thus Noah did." That's the next statement after God's finished talking. Thus, Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. This, brethren, this then forms the nucleus of what our response must be. We need to do what we know to do. God has not left us wanting for information. He has not left us wondering what to do, how to do it. He hasn't left us wondering what's coming down the pike. We know. I would challenge you in your head to put your name there. Thus, Tim did. Again, another statement I would love to have said about me. Brethren, we have to have that mindset. Genesis 7:1. Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark. Again, this is commentaries are 40 to 75 years later. Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Again, God again reaffirms his assessment. And God is the one that said, get in the ark. Noah didn't sort of think, oh, I'm done, I think. You know, let me see if I can, you know, sleep overnight here and that kind of thing. You get the idea. God said, all right, it's time. Get in the ark. Get in now. Again, it can be very instructive to think through the application we could have for that in our present day, in our present time. Drop over to verse 5. Again, I know I'm kind of jumping around here, but I'm just picking out the key verses that help make the point. Verse 5. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Once again, we have a servant of God that didn't do part of it. He didn't do what he felt like. Didn't do it if it felt good or it was easy. He did all that the Lord commanded him. Can we say that about our life? Do we do all that our God commands us? Or do we get a little selective about it? Do we get a little picky about it? Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Drop down to verse 12. And the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife, and their three wives, and their sons with them, entered the ark. On the very same day, the rain started to fall. God said, get in there now. It's time. Again, it's very instructive. I want to look at a somewhat parallel example. Again, one we're very familiar with, but over in Genesis 18. This is, again, the example of Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 18. We'll start in verse 20. This is backing up into the story a little bit. If you recall, three angels or three men approached Abraham. And as the story unfolds, we know one of them was Christ. And two angels with him. And so that this is where Christ is saying, hey, you're going to have a son. This is what's going to happen and these kinds of things. And we come down to these verses. And the Lord said, because the outcry, again, who's making the assessment? Who's saying this? Then the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great. And because their sin is very grave. This is God, again, making an assessment. It's his decision. His call, and he's making the assessment on a group, in this case cities, not the whole world, some cities. I will go down now to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know. Then the men, these are the two angels that are with him, then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. So you got to kind of get this message. You can just envision God dispatching two of his angels, saying, go verify this, and if it is, wipe them out. As we know, that happened. But Abraham standing there, again, probably like, oh, come on, man. My cousin, you know, is in that city and probably having some compassion. I think we do. You know, just like Jeremiah, it's like, you know Israel sinning, but you still cry because the city fell and has gone into captivity. And I think, you know, being a patriotic American, we kind of identify with that. I don't want my country to fail, but we know it's going to. But again, so he dispatches them. And then, as we know, it goes on here. We won't read the rest of this chapter, but Abraham does actually interact with God and say, Can we save it if you find 50 righteous? Gets them all the way down. You know, it goes down 45, 40, 30. Gets them down to 10. And again, he's like, yep, if those angels find 10 righteous people, I'll spare the city. So I want to pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 19. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Now Lot likely recognized these as the angels of the Lord. This was at a time when there was some face-to-face discussions, and these angels had probably come along, or these men, and again, I think this is the first time that refers to them as angels. Prior to this, it's men. But he probably recognized them. He understood who was standing there and understood who just showed up at the gates of the city. So again, Lot had a certain awareness of what was about, or not what was about to happen, but at least who was presenting themselves to him. Drop down to verse 12. Verse 12, then the men, these are the two angels, then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here, sons-in-laws, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in this place, take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. This is the first time. As we know, there's a lot that happened in between here. This is the first time Lot is made aware of a judgment that had taken place, and a decision, a moment, and if you will, a day of decision that had taken place, that God had made. Now his servant is informed, and that should be very comforting for us, quite frankly. I think as the study unfolded for me, it was fascinating. God will inform his servants. You won't be left wondering, but the pattern that we see is the preparation work was ready. Because both Abraham and Lot, or Noah and Lot, I should say, the two examples we looked at, they were ready. And that decision was made before they knew the calamity was about to come. God made the assessment and then informed his servants. That pattern is repeated in so many places throughout the Bible. These are, I think, the only two we're going to take a look at. But it is all over the place. So Lot is now informed. So we'll read on here. It says, so Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws who had married his daughters and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. When the morning dawned and the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wives and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. Again, there's not a lot of time. Just like Noah, get in the ark now. The rain's coming. And he did. Lot here had to be drug out a little bit, but he got out. And while he lingered, my guess is, and again, it doesn't mention his son-in-laws, my guess is he's waiting for them to show up. It's not that he was hanging around thinking, I don't know if I want to go. I think it was like, some of my family's not here, but that's supposition on my part. And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hands, his wife's hands, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out of the city and set him outside the city. And so it came to pass, when they brought them outside, that he said, escape for your lives. Do not look behind nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. Again, Lot, we see some of the basic same principles. He went and he did, just like Noah. As soon as the angels were done, he went out, tried to find his sons-in-laws, tried to convince them to go with him, tried to convince them to get out of the city. You don't wait. Neither one of these examples did they wait. They went out and got to work. And once you're out, brethren, we'll drop down to verse 26, because we know this happened. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Once you're out, you don't look back. You know, here it seems so logical. It seems, well, I mean, did she just glance back and that was enough? And I'm sure, you know, there's a thorough study. This would show that it was much more than that. But the analogous one back to Noah, I mean, can you imagine? Once the family was on the ark, one of his sons going, you know what? I'm just not sure about this whole flood thing. I know it's like 30 feet deep out there and pretty much everybody's gone. And bailing, jumping overboard. Nobody does that. Once you're out, stay out. Don't look back, and we don't go back. Again, I mentioned this principle throughout the Bible, throughout many, many verses on it, or many examples are in the Bible. Just for references, again, you can see this principle in the fall of Judah. Again, you've got the Lord saying, I've sent my prophets, I've warned you, everybody knows. And the decision at some point was made in heaven. He informs his servants inform the people, and it is executed. But the judgment call was made. And the way it's worded, the verse I'm thinking of, it's God says, you know, I did all this. I sent you my prophets. I sent my servants. And you killed them. You murdered them. And he says, until there was no remedy. And it got down to where it's like, there's no other way this is going to happen. So again, you can see the basics of the principle there. The coming of Christ, a very positive thing. All of Judah was looking for this Messiah to come. They were aware of it. They understood it. Some had their hearts and minds prepared. The calling of the disciples could be used as a microcosm of that. John came and prepared them. They were looking. They didn't necessarily know Christ was here. I mean, if you think about it, the first time Christ came, God had to inform people, hey, guess what? First of all, he informs Mary, you're pregnant, you know, and explains the situation, informs her husband, which is like, this shouldn't be, you know, and we know the story. But the point is, they had to be informed. The decision was made, and they had to be informed of it. And the Magi coming around, all of those things that wasn't well known. It was only later that John and the apostles understood who this man was. It was as God began to reveal it. You could analyze your own calling in light of this principle. God was working in all of our lives well before you became aware, hey, something's going on. This is starting to make sense. It's just the way God works. Again, you could go through almost any parable and you see a lot of the same basic principles being laid out. So again, if we sort of step back and we sort of take, okay, you know, ask the question, what have we learned so far? What are primarily the two examples we just read through? What do they teach us? What do they instruct us of the way God deals with these things and the way God handles? I came up with a list here. One, God makes assessments and decisions in heaven, or on his heavenly throne, if you will. He could be here, but he's the one making the decision. And sometimes that decision is the prevailing state of a group. It's not always the individual. Now again, that got to clarify that. Individual, in the end of the day, yes. But just like God condemned the whole world, he said, all flesh. Well, Noah was a flesh, and his family was flesh. All flesh is evil. But then he comes down and said, but you're my righteous one. And you're pure in your generations. So sometimes it's on a group. Think of the churches in Revelation. Is everybody in Philadelphia perfect? What were they? Again, if you ascribe, and I think there's some merit to it, that predominantly Philadelphia, if you think of it in the bell curve, was during the age of Mr. Armstrong. 80% of them are gone. But that still would have the prevailing thought. This is how God looked at his people and said, I'm putting an open door before you. Nobody can close it. I'm going to allow this. So again, there are group decisions, and it is helpful to think through that. So again, number one, God makes the assessments and the decisions in heaven. It's by him and him alone. Number two, it is based on the spiritual state of man. Not how pretty you are. Not how ugly you are, thankfully. Not how rich you are, not how poor you are, not what race you are, not any other thing. It is your spiritual state. That's the assessment that he looks at. Number three, God personally determines who is righteous and just. And again, I sort of made this point before, but God personally decides you're right, you're just, you are one of mine. And it is not our neighbor. We may value their opinion. And again, it's human. It's within us. I don't know if it was built by God within us or it was some of the corruption that Satan put within us as a race of people. to want this acceptance from somebody else. But at the end of the day, it is God's judgment that matters. And God, again, this is sort of a sub-point to that, but God personally makes that call, and He made it before the rain fell, and He made it before the brimstone falls. And specific to us, brethren, it will be made before Christ comes back. And that's hard to wrap our mind around, but we'll go on. I think we can prove this. Number four, after the decision was made, then He informs His servants. My fifth point, or my fifth lesson, I should say, that I sort of gleaned out of these. God makes a way and made a way of escape for His righteous servants. Again, very encouraging, because it can be very daunting to contemplate some of the things we read in Revelation, some of the things that we may well hear on the Feast of Trumpets, and some of the difficult times that are coming ahead of us. But He will make a way of escape. My sixth point, when you know calamity is coming, don't delay. Just like Noah and just like Lot, you go and you do. You get in the escape pod when it's there and you go. In Noah's case, he had to build it. But when God says go, you go. And my final point, which is really a restatement of the main topic we're talking about, in that day that a decision was made, you're either prepared or you're not. Noah and Lot were prepared, and their lives were spared. Brethren, again, I think by now you've drawn the conclusion of where we're the core topic that we're leading toward. That there is a decision point that we in this room and all of God's people, wherever they may be, are working toward. If you are alive and you remain, we are working toward this point. And there is coming a day when a decision will be made. And that's what we work toward. And it is the point where God will begin to directly intervene in the affairs of men. I think a lot of times, and I think I have historically looked at the day that we're driving towards, the day the feet stand on the Mount of Olives. And again, it is a pivotal moment. It is a hugely pivotal moment. But we know there are events that will happen before that. And there are things, you know, we have a 3.5-year window, for instance. We have a place of safety. The decision whether you're in a place of safety, it says, pray that you are accounted worthy to escape it. 3.5 years is a long time. There's decisions that are made at least that early, before the feet stand on Mount of Olives. So again, it is the time, and I use the term very carefully, it is the time where God begins to intervene directly in the affairs of men. And the time is coming, and that decision moment, the way I envision it, God the Father, Jesus Christ, Christ ready to come back, and God the Father says, it's time to go back. That's when the decisions are made. And I'm not saying your fate is sealed throughout that time. We have clear scriptures that there will be those who are called. Those will be those who come in during that time. I'm speaking to the point where we are driving toward that moment. We know. This should be our goal. This should be what's on the forefront of our mind. That moment in time. So again, there is a point where a decision is made, time of the Lord, time when God begins to intervene, and then the return of Christ. If you would turn back to Luke 17. Luke 17, we'll start in verse 26. And as it was in the days of Noah, and again, we just briefly rehearsed that, but notice it is the days, plural, of Noah. It is the time. Then we could say maybe it was just the time he was building the ark. Maybe it was the whole time, but it wasn't the day Noah entered the ark. It wasn't that one moment in time. It was as it was in the days of Noah, so it will also be in the days, plural, of the Son of Man. So there is a time frame. And the culture and the environment that we're talking about will be similar. Wickedness will grow. But it is, again, days of the Son of Man. Not the day in which he stands on the Mount of Olives. And he goes on to explain and make this exact point. They ate, they drank, they married wives. They were given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. These are the days. It is the time frame leading up to that moment when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Again, making the exact same point. There is a time period. There's a time period when God began to intervene in the world and in two cities and made a judgment call. And there is a day then when that judgment was executed. But it is a time period. It is a time when God will directly intervene in the affairs of men. And that day is coming. But again, note, this was going on until that day. And none of these things are inherently wrong. That's why I said earlier, it could be a day just like this. I'm sure somebody somewhere is getting married. I'm sure there are things going on. Somebody's buying, selling, planting, building. These things are courses of life. This is the time frame we're talking about. Again, imagine a day like today where God's in heaven and says, all right, you know what? It's time. We got to go. Let's pick it up in verse 29. But on the day Lot went out of Sodom, maybe I already read this one, it rained fire and brimstone. Verse 30. Even so, it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So again, the day we're talking about here is the day of the beginning of the revealing of the Son of Man. You know, the Bible terms it a lot of different ways. And if you think of just the term day, we're driving toward the beginning of the day, not the end of it. Would be another way of looking at it. I think, in fact, the weekly Sabbath, I think John Paul mentioned in the prayer, and it reminded me of it, that it's like that metaphor works too. That's a day of rest. The Sabbath represents the millennium. What are we in right now? We're in a day of preparation. For what? In the 6,000-year window, we're leading up to the 7,000th year. It's called the day of preparation. But we drive towards sundown, if you will, in that metaphor. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're that's when we enter. That's what we're driving toward. So again, in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. And again, if we read Revelation, God will be revealed well before he stands on the Mount of Olives. We know the last year, he directly and miraculously intervenes in the affairs of men. There will be no other explanation. We know every eye will see and every ear will hear. That all occurs leading up to the day, again, that the mount is stood on by our Savior. So this is the day of his revealing. And again, I think that the following verses really back this up. Because it says in verse 31, in that day he was on the housetop and his goods are in the house. Let him not come down and take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. And again, a lot of times, and actually a lot of commentaries will talk about this being the day that Christ comes back and stands on the Mount of Olives. But we, you know, with the understanding we have, the problem with that is if you're on the housetop and it's that day, you have risen to meet your Savior in the air. There's not really a chance, and it's in the moment, in a twinkling of an eye, there's not a chance to go back. This is a time where you can make that call. You can decide to go down. You can decide, no, you know what, I got stuff to do. So again, it actually illustrates the point that it is some time prior to that. And then we get the admonition, remember Lot's wife. Again, don't look back. When you're out, don't look back. This world is coming to an end. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you, in that night, there will be two men in one bed, and one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding together, and one will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field, and one will be taken and the other left. I love the way Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown words this. Their complete statement is, they sum up these three verses by saying, this is referring to the prepared and the unprepared. Their full statement is, the prepared and the unprepared mingled together in ordinary walks and fellowships of life when the moment of severance arrives. Again, it's going to be a day just like today. And I keep using that metaphor to illustrate. It may not be flashes of light. I actually use the analogy to my wife. It's not like in football, you get a 2-minute warning. Everybody gets to huddle up. We get to go to our sideline, talk to our coach a little bit. All right, we got 2 minutes. Here's our game plan. Here's what we're going to do. We know. We've been warned. We've got the warning sitting in your lap. If there was a 2-minute warning, it happened 2,000 years ago, roughly. We're in the final minutes of the game. Brethren, we have the warning. There isn't going to be a flashlight. There isn't going to be a big heralding bell. Now again, we'll talk about it a little bit. There will be servants. There will be the Elijahs. There will be the two witnesses. So again, we're not going to be left wondering what's going on. But today, as we sit here, we are preparing for that moment. And again, we're not going to get a 2 minutes. So this is talking principally about the prepared and unprepared. When that moment comes, there will be some that are, and there will be some that did not do what they needed to do. Again, I think it's here. We go on. It may not be this one. It's the other one, or the next verse we're going to read. But think of the virgins. Everybody was ready. Everybody knew what to do. They all had it. Half were and half were not. So again, we're talking about the time. This is the time we're working toward, brethren. The end of the age of man. The beginning of the end of the age of man. And the beginning of the transition into the age of God. And the great millennial time that is coming. When Christ will once again rule the earth. Turn back to Matthew 24. This is not actually an exact parallel, but it covers many of the same ideas and topics. But Matthew 24 actually expounds on it a little bit in a way I think is very helpful. Matthew 24, and we'll pick it up in verse 36. Now this is after Christ was asked the questions, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? He gives a lot of vital instructions ahead of this, but essentially from here on out, he's answering the question, since we know this, since we know Christ is returning, what should we do? How should we respond? What is our obligation? What is our duty? Since we know this, the rest of the Olivet Discourse really deals with this topic. And again, I think it's merciful that Christ gives us so much information, so much knowledge. Because it instructs us, brethren. It helps us, as we'll read here in a minute, to put a godly fear in our life. And understand, he means exactly what he says. He means it exactly that way. So again, I want to start in verse 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. I have a question. Do you need to know the day Christ is coming back? Do you need to know when that decision is going to be made? No, you don't. Christ, if we did, we would have been told. Christ is saying nobody knows. He's saying, I don't even know at this point. I shouldn't say I'm hoping. My guess is he may well know now. I don't know. He may still not know. But I'll tell you this. Christ, when he died, he said, I'm going to prepare a place for you. Do you think Christ went back and did? Do you think he went back and started preparing a place for you? I think he did. I think Christ is ready. I think Christ is ready for the Father to say, it's time. I don't think when God says, hey, it's time, that he gets, you get the, just a minute, I got a few other things I need to go do, and we got to finalize this. The table is ready. The offer has been slid across the table, if you will, to everyone in this room and every one of God's people, wherever they are. The offer is on the table. We have merely to take it. And again, that illustrates sort of the nucleus of the point I'm trying to make today. That offer was given to you before you even knew it was on the table. It was given to you. And you didn't earn it, but it's being offered eternal life in His family. What are we doing today? What are we doing right now to get ready to enter that family? Again, it's a bit of a sidetrack there. But the core question I wanted to address in this verse today, is Christ ready? I think He is. I don't think He put any of it off. Verse 37. But as in the days, again plural, of Noah were, so also will the coming of Son of Man be. It's going to be the same, a period of time. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Again, there is coming a time when it's going to happen. And just like with Noah, the decision was made. Informed his servants. His servants prepared and built an ark in this case. And I suppose we have our own ark. But they will not know until it comes and takes them all away. Verse 40. These are kind of similar thoughts, so I'm not spending much time on them. Then two men will be in the field, and one will be taken and the other left. Two women grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch, therefore, for you do not know the hour your Lord is coming. Our first admonition, that's why I wanted to sort of read this 1 second. He says, watch. So I just want to highlight it this time. We're going to come back and address that. But he says, watch, therefore, because you don't know. Watch. I suppose by implication you could say, well, if you did know, you really wouldn't have to watch, because he kind of goes on and talks about it. If you knew when the thief was coming, you could just wait and club them over the head when they come in. But he's saying, watch. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Again, by implication, he would have spent all the other time not watching. Christ says, watch. Therefore, you also be ready. Again, a simple statement. It's the next one I wanted to highlight here. Be ready. It is a state of being. It is not something you do later after you get the 2-minute warning. It's not something you do after you're part of the group that gets to see, you know, every eye will see. So if you're alive and at that time, you don't wait. That's the point I'm trying to make. Don't wait. You've got the opportunity now. We're not at loss of what's coming. Don't wait. Be ready. Again, to be ready on the day of decision is to be ready all along. It's a way of life. It is a state of being. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. Again, this really cannot, I say cannot, this really is not talking about the day He's going to stand on the Mount of Olives. I think by the time that happens, there's going to be a lot of us that are expecting Him. Because there will have been a lot of events. If you think about it, and if we have it all right, when we go into the place of safety, we're on a bit of a clock. We know it's 3.5 years. We can all sort of figure out, well, we left, you know, and it's probably going to be, you know, if it is trumpets on this year. But he's saying, you don't know. be ready. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his house to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find him so doing. Again, we mentioned it with Noah and Lot. Go and do. So doing. We have to be found so doing what our master has asked us to do. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him rule over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Again, it's important also, I think, highlight when we see things like there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth in the virgins and all these other parables we get. These are not people that were ignorant. These are people that thought they would be there. These are people that thought, I'm on the inside, and are surprised when they get up. And we won't read it today. I think it's Luke 13. When the master of the house gets up, walks across the room, and shuts the door. These are the people that pile up outside, wondering why they can't get in. There comes a time when Christ is going to go shut the door. Brethren, weeping and gnashing of teeth comes from people that know they should have been inside. They should have been inside the room, and they didn't do what they needed to do when they had the chance. I mean, if you think about it from God's master plan, there has to be sort of a summing up, a sort of a finality to his creative energy for this age, for the age of the first fruits. He has to sort of wind that down. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about character. And I know we have the parables of Christ and people being called at the 11th hour and being given a penny. But the 11th hour probably is not 2 minutes before Christ returns, or 2 minutes before we're changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye. So again, we have time now, brethren. Let us not fetter it away. Let us have these thoughts. Again, it is a state of being. And I've talked about it here before, so I won't belabor the point. But one of the greatest enemies of this state of preparedness is what I have, and it results from a conversation I had with somebody in the church. But I call it the bell lap theory, and if you recall, I've talked about it before. The bell lap theory basically says, you know, in human terms, when we're running a race, we know we all get fatigued and we wind down to nothing. The bell lap theory says, wait till you hear that in longer races. Wait till you hear the bell, then you give it everything you got to barely eke across the finish line. I think that is an attitude Satan would love you to have. Because what's it going to do? It's going to cause you to wait till you get a 2-minute warning, and it's going to cause you to be lethargic about it. That's not what God says. He says, I give you every spiritual blessing every day. We can get on our knees every day and ask for more of the Holy Spirit. And He says, I will give it to you. Spiritual life gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger as you go. You don't weaken. That's why I say I think the devil would love for you to think that way. I got to hold my spiritual energy in reserve because I know it's going to get tough. No, man. We are all out spiritually. Again, we see it a lot of times. How many times you hear people, or you know, you talk to the widowers, the elderly maybe, in the church that have been here for years, and sometimes they just put you to shame with the words of wisdom that come out of your mouth. Physically, yeah, they're weakened. And yes, the young are stronger. But spiritually, man, some of these are giants. So again, I don't want to belabor the point, but don't buy into the bell lap theory. We have to be all in on this. So again, I mentioned a couple things, highlighted a few things as we read through that. I want to go back and just address a few of them. Because Christ gives us some very vital keys in this section of verse to being ready, to what we ought to do and how we ought to approach this and where we ought to be. First one I want to talk about, I've mentioned it a few times, go and do. It's what I've titled it. Will I find my servants doing when I come back? I want to turn back to Ezekiel 33. You'll probably recognize this section of verse. Ezekiel 33 is the watchman. We know, and again, I know there are people that will ascribe that the watchman's already come and give a lot of credit to Mr. Armstrong for this. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, I don't know. I know this. If you read this, the watchman is focused on primarily one thing, the spiritual state of God's people. And again, we don't have time to read the whole verse or the whole chapter. It's very instructive to come back and read it. The watchman, again, just, I guess, highlighting, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Therefore, you, O man, say to the children of your people. I'm only reading that because I laid my eyes on it. And it's talking to the people of God. This is who this audience is. It's you. It's me. The verses I want to read, again, the point that we're backing up is what Christ said about go and do. I'm saying go and do. He said, will I find him so doing? We actually have to be doing it, not just learning it. This is how we end this chapter on the watchman. That will come, you know, it applied back then, and it's going to apply again if it hasn't already. I want to start in verse 30. As for you, he's talking to the watchman, son of man, the children of your people are talking about you beside the wall and in the dorms of the houses. And they speak one to another, everyone saying to his brother, please come, hear what the word of the Lord, the word is that comes from the Lord. So here they are. I mean, you can kind of, it's almost, you know, there's so much buzz, there's so much going on. People are like, man, you got to come hear this guy. You got to come hear what this watchman is saying. Verse 31. So they come to you, or they come to you as people do, and sit before you as my people. Again, these are the people of God. And they hear your words, but they do not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart pursues their own gain. Brethren, does this not apply to our modern day? Whether you're talking in the world, which is rampant, or unfortunately a lot of times even within our church and within our congregations and within our families. For with their mouth they show much love, but with their heart they pursue their own gain. Indeed, you are to them a very lovely song of one who has a pleasant voice and can play well on the instruments. For they hear your words, but they do not do them. It's a state of being again. We have to hear the words. Whether we read them, whether we pray, whether we study, we have to hear the words and go do it. It's part of what God is saying. And Christ is saying back in Matthew 24 that his servants will be doing on that day of decision. They will be doing the word. Another one we highlighted back then, or back in Matthew 24, was watching. Where it said, watch, for you do not know the hour in which your Lord is coming. I have a question. How did Christ watch? What's the biblical example? Again, when we hear words, we conjure up a given image. How did Christ watch? What did he do? Turn back to Matthew 26. I think I've said before that when Christ says to watch, he didn't have CNN in mind. Again, perfectly fine to keep up with world events and read all the stuff you want. It's healthy. We ought to do those things, and I'm not speaking against that. But what is sort of the primary message? What's the primary thing we ought to think when we hear that Christ says, watch, therefore? Matthew 26. Let me get there first, so I beat you. Matthew 26, And we'll start in verse 36. This is Christ during the agony in the garden. Again, we know these scriptures so well. But notice what is said. Then Jesus came to them in a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciple, "Sit here while I go over there. Go and pray over there." And he took with him Peter, the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." So Christ is saying, stay here and watch with me. He went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Then he came to his disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Christ watched his heart, he watched his mind through prayer. That's the biblical example we have of watching. When God and Christ say, "Watch, therefore, for you don't know," I think there is clearly the element of looking at the trends and looking at the seasons. But remember the example we had from Noah and Lot. It is a spiritual assessment. That's what we have to watch. That's what we have to be careful of. We won't turn there, but 1 Peter 4:7 says, "But the end of all things is at hand." This is the time frame we're talking about. "The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers." This is where we have to watch. Our hearts and our minds. Don't let corruption take hold. Don't let roots of bitterness get in. They are corrosive and they destroy your life. And there's a thousand other things. And one of my favorite sayings is, it doesn't matter which one takes you down. All Satan cares is one of them does. And if it's a root of bitterness, he'll use it. If it's anger, he'll use it. If it's pornography, he'll use it. If it's drinking, he'll use it. If it's drugs, he'll use it. He doesn't care. Just pick one. And he's happy. We have to be watchful in our prayers. Turn back to 1 Peter 3. First Peter chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 20. There is another thing, and I've titled it, "A Good Conscience Toward God." And again, I keep going back to the same sort of core point, because it speaks to these. To be ready on that day, we have to have a good conscience toward God. 1 Peter 3, we'll start in verse 20. "Who formerly were disobedient when once the divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 souls, were saved through water. There is also an antitype which saves us now, baptism. Not the removal of filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus the Christ." A good conscience toward God. It is liberating. It is purifying. Brethren, if you have unrepented of sins in your life, clean them up. I think Mr. Vernage is one that has sort of kept this mantra going. Every night, every day, seek forgiveness for your sins. It is healthy at the end of every day to scan your life. Scan what happened that day. And make sure they're confessed before our God. A clean, good conscience toward God must be present. And the beauty of it is, again, this is imminently available to every single one of us. We're not left wanting. We're not left with trying to figure out how to do this. He's given us clear, and He's invited us. Come do this. I want to forgive. I want to see you as pure. Turn back to Hebrews 11. Brethren, we, again, the scenario, you know, it's the old saying, names and people have been changed to protect. Well, names and people have changed, been changed here too. But we, brethren, we too have been divinely warned. We're not, again, I've said it 2-3 times, we are not left wondering what's coming. And we're not left wondering what's expected of us. Hebrews 11, verse 7. Says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear. He was divinely warned. So are we, brethren. We are divinely warned. My question is, do we move with godly fear? Do we move with it? Godly fear should cause you to, I don't know how you can sin. And the only time, we all do. I know when I do, it's because I don't have that in my life. At the moment it happens. By faith. And even this illustrates. Noah had faith. Being divinely warned. He already had faith. He believed God. He believed God would do exactly what He said. When God said it's going to be a flood, he believed Him. And he moved with godly fear. Prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Again, we have to move with a very godly fear. Remember what we said. We get the idea Noah left that discussion with God and went out and got to work. I think he expects the same of us. Second Peter. Again, this was a point we highlighted earlier. I just want to read one scripture to back it up. God will spare the righteous. When He makes that judgment call, and He says, that one, that's one of mine. That's my child. He will spare. 2 Peter chapter 2, we'll start in verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell, delivering them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in a flood, the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemning them to destruction, making them an example to those who would afterwards live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, fomented his righteous soul from day to day, by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. God does know how to deliver. He delivered Noah, He delivered Lot, and He will deliver His people. It is very reassuring and very comforting. So what do we take away from this today? What are the things, if we don't take anything else, well, I'd hope we'd remember the one point. But that's my last of the takeaways, so we'll stop, we'll wait for that one. But what are the takeaways? Again, I got a nice list that I came up with. Number one, God does give warnings. we are warned. He will send his Elijahs. We have his words. We today have access to more information than any other age of man has ever had. You can go home tonight and do a search and find hundreds of hours of sermons given by God's people. Thousands, tens of thousands of pages of commentary on the book that's in your lap. Best of all, you got the book. And we've got the complete book. A lot of the servants didn't have all that we have. But he will warn. So brethren, we cannot say, when we're standing before the judgment seat, we cannot say we were not warned. Number two, God gives time. Again, I referenced it before. I really do believe he's given man 2,000 years. That ought to be enough time. He knows when the conditions are right. And I do think, again, he makes assessments on, in this case, it's going to be like Noah. I keep saying, like in, as in the days of Noah, he's going to make an assessment on the community in the world. We cannot say then that we didn't have the time to prepare. We can't say that. We're not going to be able to tell him, you know what, you just didn't give me enough time. God would not have called you if there wasn't enough time for you to get ready. The fact that you're called alone illustrates there is time. My third takeaway, God gives the means. We have the tools. We have the instructions. I mean, again, we highlighted one of the great tools, going to God and seeking forgiveness. Getting that clean conscience. It's a great tool. I hope we're using it. We need to. He has given us, again, the tools and instructions. We cannot say, you didn't give us the tools. You didn't give us the means to do it, God. Sorry. If you had just given me this other thing, then I would have been there for you. It's not going to cut it. My fourth takeaway is being ready is a state of being. And we start immediately. We do not wait. I heard a minister once actually ask the question, would it matter to you if you knew 3 years from now, well, we'll round it up. If you knew 3.5 years from now Christ was going to return, what would you do? I mean, not... well, it could happen. You knew it was going to happen. What if you knew if it was 5 years? Would it make a difference that you had a little extra time? What if it was 10? Would that make a difference? And again, I think he made a great point. He goes, he takes it out further, 10, 20, 30 years. His point was simply, if you're not going to do it, if it's 3.5 years away, you'll never do it. We have to go and do. We have to take advantage of the time now. Either we will or we won't. We've been duly warned. We've been given the time. We've been given the tools and the means. We have to go and do. And just like we just read in Hebrews, we have to move with godly fear. My fifth takeaway is to remember decisions are made in heaven by God, not a man. And they're made at a time when we may not be aware that that call is being made. That he's looking down and saying, you, fill in your name, are one of my righteous ones, and I'm going to protect you. And you're going to be in my family. And just like with Noah, 70-ish years later, he reaffirms, you are my righteous servant because you do all that I command you. He said it twice about him. Again, a pretty good gap of time. Noah kept it up. Speaks to the point of once you're in, you don't look back. You don't bail out. You don't give up. Well, made it. Good. We stick with it. My sixth takeaway is God will protect those who are his. Again, in all of this, I don't want it to be lost. God will protect his servants. And my final takeaway, when the day comes, when that day comes, we are either prepared or we're not. It is a moment in time that will come. And again, you could step back and take the analogy of the Sabbath. There is a moment when the sun sets and the Sabbath begins. And we're in it at that point. We're there. When that day comes, one is either prepared or they're not. Again, the main point of the message today is to be prepared on that day of decision. Brethren, we will have been prepared all along. We will be doing. We will be watching. We will be praying. We will be doing those things. So as we look forward to the reign of Christ, and again, I'm confident in 2 weeks and 5-6 days, we'll hear some messages relative and very specific about that day and the return of Christ. As we look forward to the reign of Christ, let us remember to be prepared for that day of decision, that day what we are working toward, the day when our Lord looks down and He finds us so doing. And make sure that that day does not come upon us, again, as it says, I'll use biblical language, that day, the moment of decision, like this one, doesn't come upon us unawares.